Hi everyone, how are you going? And can I just start by saying great to see you all here? And can I please request that nobody use their AI companion on Zoom? I don't give consent for any of my words to be used in AI. So don't do it, please. So I've been asked to say a few words on this topic. So let me give, I guess, a bit of a background for myself, like why as a Buddhist monk talking about AI. And I'm sure that there are many people here who know more about this topic than I do. But of course, I want to try to bring a Dhamma perspective to it. So, as a kid, I was a great science fiction geek. And so I read all of the old science fiction masters and so on. Few, most of them were men. Ursula Le Guin. There's some exceptions, but anyway, and I honestly believe that having a childhood reading science fiction is probably the most useful education you can have for understanding the world as it is today, and especially the impact of technologies like AI. And one of the problems that we find in trying to communicate about these issues is that when you try to talk about them with people who haven't read science fiction, you sound like you're mad. And the people who are running the AIs do this all the time. They talk about science fiction and so on all the time. They were all science fiction geeks and they're all inspired by these things. And they say these things and they sound mad because they literally are mad. And then when you try to describe what it is that they're saying, you sound mad for talking about it and taking them seriously. Now, I wouldn't take them seriously if they were just some random bloggers or some guys smoking a joint in their dorm room and riffing about consciousness and so on, which is where these conversations should have remained. But now they're running the world's biggest companies and they are determining all kinds of things that are happening in our worlds, in our classrooms, and in our homes. And so we need to take them seriously and actually listen to what it is that they're saying. So let me briefly begin by talking a bit about what we mean by consciousness from a Buddhist point of view, and then to look at the scenario of what we're talking about when we're talking about modern AI. So most of you, I think, have some familiarity with Buddhism and with Buddhist ideas of consciousness, so I won't spend too much time talking about this, but let me just give a brief summary. The Buddha described consciousness as being something which is conditioned. Consciousness is not a metaphysical entity. It's not something that exists eternally. It's something which is caused and created by the conditions in which a living organism, a sentient being, Satta or Buddha, finds itself. And of course, it's the medium through which sentient beings continue to be reborn from one life until the next. Now, the Buddha commonly used organic imagery when he was talking about consciousness. Consciousness is a seed, literally, consciousness, vijnanam bijam, consciousness is the seed. It's planted in the field of karma and it's sprinkled with the moisture of craving. And when it's planted, it grows, develops, and matures. And this is a literal growth. The Buddha talks about consciousness maturing into a young boy or girl, growing up and becoming a person. And so, this idea of consciousness is always embedded within an organic system that we call a person or a living being, and so on. Now, these systems, which are who we are of course, exceedingly complex, and they have an irreducible phenomenological depth, by which I mean that when you close your eyes and you look inside at what's going on, you can always look further. And there are always layers of unpacking who it is that's here and what we are conscious of. Now, at its simplest, consciousness is simply the awareness of some sense impression. So we open our eyes, we see. Depending on the eye and sights, arises eye consciousness. Now, that eye consciousness is purely sees light. So it sees wavelengths of light. So you see light, but you don't see objects. In the room I'm sitting here now, I don't see chairs, I don't see walls, I don't see floors. I just see light. And all of those other things are part of the perceptions and interpretations that my mind makes up. So the eye consciousness purely sees light, sounds, smells, so on and so forth, and then mind consciousness. And mind consciousness, of course, where most of the action takes place. Now, mind consciousness is a kind of a funny thing because it is clearly, I think on a moment's reflection, is obviously the most important thing about all of our lives. And at a fundamental level, it is who we identify ourselves to be. And, we could easily imagine having an accident and losing our sense of sight, and it wouldn't change who we are. But if we lost our mind, then who we are is gone. So our mind consciousness is in a way like the core of what we take to be ourselves. Now, the Buddha, of course, said that what we take to be a self is not ultimately anything which is permanent and lasting. And ultimately, what we have is not some entity that exists forever. What we have is a system. And that system consists of interrelating energies. And in the mind, we have consciousness, which is the awareness of all of those other things, thoughts, feelings, perceptions, memories, all of those things, as well as sensory input and everything like that. So our mind is always in this system where there is an awareness of what is happening. In dependent origination, they call this vijnana, is the consciousness. Nama rupa is all of the other phenomena that make up the world, mental and physical phenomena that make up the world. So this is the Buddha's model of consciousness. And through this model, he was deliberately opposing models of consciousness that posited that consciousness was some kind of eternal absolute. So this was of course, the Upanishadic point of view, that consciousness is like the ocean and the nama rupa, the phenomena of the world, are like the rivers that flow into the ocean. Yeah. Actually, the Buddha's model is much more similar to our physical understanding of the ocean, because physically we know that, well, the ocean isn't some infinite static body of water, but is also part of a cycle. And the water evaporates from the ocean and rains on the mountains, and that also is the nama rupa. So that model, actually, the natural model, is very similar to the idea of what the Buddha was talking about when he was talking about consciousness. So if you want to try to understand how the Buddha talked about who we are and how the human being is made up, then using these kinds of natural models of like evolution and ecologies and biological systems is a really good place to start. Now, having said which, don't mistake the Buddha for being a materialist. Okay, the Buddha was not a materialist and he was not a reductionist. He didn't say that the world is just made up of matter, and he certainly didn't say that the mind is something that is an emergent property from matter. Rather, he would say rather than talking about fundamental substances. Okay, the Buddha didn't talk about fundamental substances. He didn't say there's fundamentally a mind and fundamentally a matter and so on and so forth. The Buddha talked about experience. And in the primal experience is of an interrelation. So our experience, that your experience as you're sitting here right now, is of a connection between mind, physical things, our responses to those physical things, our awareness of it, our memories, our perceptions, and all of those things making a complex system. Just as our experience of nature, the primary experience is the system, the ecology is the primary reality. So we can try to tease out the different aspects of that system to understand it. But it's not like somebody said, okay, I'm going to assemble this bit, this bit, this bit, this bit, this bit, and then engineer a mind from putting those bits together. That's not how evolution works. Huh? It's something that comes from within, driven by craving. So craving is what sets all this in motion, and craving is what forms our experience in the manner that we have it. Ajahn Brahm many years ago pointed out that it's not simply that we have craving for our senses, right? We don't just crave sense experience, but rather when we understand dependent origination, we understand that we created our senses in order to have something to sate our craving. Yeah, that's how this system works. There's a driving force. All right, so this is giving you very briefly a model for how consciousness works in early Buddhism. Now, that consciousness obviously is subtle. It's difficult to see. And the Buddha found that even the great sages and philosophers of his time had misunderstood, because they'd taken consciousness to be some entity, some eternal thing. So consciousness is difficult to see, but from a Buddhist point of view, it's not impossible. And the Buddha taught, of course, the Eightfold Path, and especially the practice of deep meditation, in which the nature of consciousness is revealed. So what in Western philosophy is often called the hard problem of consciousness is not a hard problem in Buddhism, in the sense of being inexplicable or unsolvable. It is precisely the problem, or one aspect of the problem, that the Buddha himself solved. So now this model of consciousness and this way of thinking about consciousness is something that is experienced from the inside. It's experienced by the person who is conscious. And that, of course, is the path of meditation, is to lead us to a greater awareness of the consciousness that we ourselves have. And that's quite a different model of consciousness than that which is developed mostly in Western psychology, and especially in the field of AI, which I'm going to turn to now. So I think it's fairly obvious that one of the differences between Indian Dharmic religions and Western science is that Dharmic religions approach things subjectively and Western science approaches things objectively. I think that's fairly obvious. In the case of intelligence, in the case of the mind, that objectification of intelligence reached its high point in, I think it was probably like the 50s and 60s, with a movement called behaviorism. So behaviorism posited essentially that mind is what mind does, and that we should not only kind of give up trying to understand the mind as such, but kind of the mind doesn't even really exist, that all we can really say that exists is what people say and what people do. And this is a kind of rather strange position for psychology to have, to say that there's no psyche, but that was very popular through the 50s and 60s before being largely abandoned by psychologists in subsequent years. The reason that I bring that up was because it was in the 1950s that the artificial intelligence field was started. And one of the first theorists, most famous theorists in that field, of course, is Alan Turing. And he wrote a seminal paper on that, where he proposed what these days is usually called the Turing test, and he calls the imitation game. And the imitation game is based essentially on a behaviorist model of the mind. I'm not sure if he was doing this consciously, but it was certainly part of that spirit of how people were thinking about the mind at that time. So his idea, the Turing test idea, was essentially that if you can make a machine that imitates humanity, then you have to consider that it is conscious. I mean, this is a simplification, but that's the basic idea. So if your computer can fool you into thinking that it's intelligent, then it's intelligent. You have to regard it as intelligent. And he's a bit skittish on the question of whether it actually is intelligent or whether you have to regard it as intelligent. But anyway, that's the basic idea. So this was that proposal. And for practical purposes, we haven't really, although I think the computer science world hasn't really moved a long way beyond that. We're still in the realm of things that try to fool us into thinking that they're intelligent. Now, as we know, computer science advanced very quickly. In the 1960s, it was already possible to write programs that would, to a certain degree, start to seem as if they almost were intelligent. And one such early program was a program called Eliza. And Eliza was written by, Eliza was the first chatbot. It was programmed as a Rogerian therapist. Okay, so this is a particular style of therapy. And the basic style of basic thing is you say something like, what were you doing? What did you do on the weekend? Oh, I saw my father. Oh, how is your father? Oh, he was fine, thank you. Oh, tell me more about your father. Well, you know, like this and so on. So the therapist just mirrors back to the person what it is that they're saying. So they're sort of trying to get them into a stream of consciousness by mirroring the things that they're saying. Now, that kind of response was quite apt to be used for developing a chatbot. So Eliza was essentially the first chatbot, and it was developed by a programmer called Joseph Weizenbaum. And I'd encourage you to check out Joseph Weizenbaum's writings on this topic. He didn't write widely, but he wrote one. There's one really good interview he gave in 1998. It's published in both German and English, and also a book he wrote in the 1970s, which is some of it is technical, but a lot of it is actually extremely prescient. So Joseph Weizenbaum was part of that first generation of computer scientists working in the States, and he developed this chatbot called Eliza. And he was quite disturbed one day when he comes into his office and his secretary was using Eliza, and she said to him, "Oh, excuse me, do you mind like leaving the room while I talk to Eliza?" And he was like, "What exactly is going on here?" And of course, he'd written the code, and you know, by today's standards, it's a very simple program. But somehow she was confiding in it as if it were real. So Weizenbaum is a very interesting character from a point of view as a computer scientist. He was actually a German Jew who fled Germany with his parents in 1936. And his like formative experience was the Nazi regime. And he argues that the essence of Nazism was dehumanization, that the beginnings of what they were doing was to depict Jewish people as subhuman and to raise one group above another and to denigrate and dehumanize. And he argues that machines and computers have the same effect. And he became increasingly disturbed by what he saw in the computer science world. Remember that he was in the heart of, you know, like Berkeley and those kinds of places in those days when they were literally laying the basis for computer science. And he said that he talked about this very disturbing way in which the image of the machine is exalted above the image of the human. And I think this is an incredibly prescient observation. I'm going to come back to that in a minute, but I just wanted to bring Joseph Weizenbaum's perspective into that. He had a number of very interesting insights into the way that the digital world was being run. Another one that he's argument that he made, which I think was incredibly prescient, and he made this argument in the 1970s. He said that he'd done a number of projects as a computer scientist for the military and for the banks. And he saw this schism between the rhetoric that was being used by the computer people. So the computer people would be like, this is a radical new change. This is an innovation. This is going to change everything. This is going to open up new frontiers, blah, blah, blah. But the way it was actually being used was to implement regressive power structures. And rather than actually being a force for progressing society, it was a force for patching up old systems so that we didn't have to question these things, but we could just keep them going by making banking a bit more efficient, by making the military a bit more efficient, by making government a bit more efficient. We can just keep going without having to really question things. And again, he made these observations in the 1970s when the digital revolution was really just getting started. And you know, here we are, how many years later is it now? 50 years later. And I don't know how it seems to you, but it seems to me that that has now obviously far more true than ever, that the digital revolution has ushered in not just a stagnation of social change, but a massive regression of it in many places, and particularly, obviously, most obviously in the United States, but in many other places as well, where you see the people who are pushing the most supposedly advanced technology, the AI and the VR and the neuro thingies and the spaceships and all of these fantasies from the science fiction books that we read when we were kids. But politically and socially, they are introducing the most regressive policies. And there's something fundamental about the technology that does that. Now, if I'm going to come back to science fiction for just a minute, I can think of, there are many science fiction authors love thinking about AI and robots and so on, and there's many different fantasies and many different scenarios. So if I'm going to think of two scenarios, right, that stick with me about the future of AI, these kind of are the two extremes, I guess, of the future of AI. One comes from Isaac Asimov, and I can't remember the name of the story. But it's quite a well-known story, fairly short and fairly simple one. But the basic idea is that somebody invents a computer, which is great, and then that does all these amazing things. And then somebody else invents another one, and then you go into the future, and then thousands of years, there's an even better one. And they keep building more and bigger computers until there's, you know, this massive, fantastic computer that's better than everything. It's millions of years in the future. And then they get it to run its final program. And what is the program that it runs? Let there be light. So now they have done what they were always wanting to do. They have built God. Yeah. And so this is that one line of development of the computer, that we are building something whose potential is so vast that it will trans. Like, I don't think Asimov was a theist, right? I don't think this should be taken literally. But the idea is that you're building something which is so incredible that it's going to transcend our ideas of what's possible. It's going to metaphysically change the nature of humanity in this world. And this kind of narrative is fueling a lot of the what we call accelerationist ideologies of Silicon Valley and Silicon Valley gurus. So just briefly on accelerationism, if you're not familiar with the term, the basic idea of accelerationism is that like development and economic growth is not enough. What we because there are all these problems, environmental problems and climate change and exhaustion of resources and extinction of species and so on and so forth. And we've reached a point where we can no longer manage those things. So the solution of the accelerationist is to just put your foot on the accelerator and go faster. Just break on through, because at the other side of it, we're going to make this godlike AI, which is going to solve all these problems for us. So I said before, you'd sound mad when you're talking about these things, but this is literally what the heads of Microsoft and the heads of Google and the heads of OpenAI and the heads of Amazon and all of these people are saying. They're all accelerationists, and they always all believe some version of these kinds of ideas. So this is, I think, one side of it, this utopian vision that we're going to transcend and become something unimaginable. Elon Musk talked about that humanity was a bootstrapping for digital. We're like a bootloader for digital consciousness, right? So our divine purpose, the reason, the ultimate purpose for humanity to exist is to create a digital supercomputer, right? And so this is where they're leading. This is what inspires them. All right. Okay, so that's one vision. The other vision comes from one of my favorite short stories of all time, Harlan Ellison's I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream. And if you haven't read that story, I strongly recommend never reading it, because it is harrowing and horrifying and really disturbing in a fundamental way, but you'll never forget it once you read it. So in I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream, essentially humanity made this big computer, which was this big AI, which then decided that it was going to kill all humans, which by itself is fairly standard fare. That's like Terminator kind of stuff. Harlan Ellison also invented the ideas behind Terminator. But anyway, so he's going to kill everything, but it's going to keep a few humans alive in perpetuity just so that it could continue to torment those humans for the crime of having created it. Right? So and creating them in ever more bizarre ways. So this is where the title comes, I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream. Yeah. So this is like if Asimov's vision is the most optimistic vision for AI, then this vision is the darkest vision for AI. And of course, in these stories, you know, you're expressing people's hopes and fears about technology. And one of the secrets to understanding science fiction is to understand it's not really about the science, it's not really about the machines, it's about humanity. It's asking what kind of people are we and what kind of things, who do we want to be in this world? Like what is our life for? How are we going to make our life matter? So as we all know, a few years ago, these science fiction kind of ideas started to become much more urgently present in our lives, especially with the release of ChatGPT, which of course caused a major shift in so many things. And there was, it seems, a kind of a tipping point in terms of the what AI could do and how they could scale it, so that they could, rather than being like a research laboratory or an occasional tool that was used by scientists and so on. So of course, similar techniques have been used by scientists for all kinds of things, right? And they use it for modeling like climate change and all kinds of things. But this idea of being able to put it out for the general public and use it for writing essays and use it as a general purpose knowledge machine, then this came about through ChatGPT, and of course the effects have been massive, and there's massive roll-on effects through education systems, through health systems, through justice systems, through political systems, and so on and so forth. And to try to unravel all of those effects would be take forever. Now, I'll just say a few things from a Buddhist point of view. So first thing from a Buddhist point of view, these things obviously are not conscious, obviously are not intelligent, and obviously will never become so. This is not an open question from a Buddhist point of view. This is obvious. These things are just statistical mashings up of data, predicting the next data based on the tokens and the weight and the probability. We know how these machines work, and it's got nothing to do with consciousness. It's got to do with essentially statistics and probability. So this tells us something. About, like, you're not going to make a better AI and then suddenly consciousness pops out at the end, right? It's just not going to work like that. So that then becomes quite disturbing when you think, like, well, if we're thinking of AI as human beings as being a bootstrap or bootloader for digital superintelligence, then actually that super consciousness that they're building isn't actually conscious at all. It's actually just a nothing. And so it's not that we're building something better than us. We're actually just building a nothing. And then that just is just running around not even being conscious at all. And it never will be. So this is, to my mind, is this abyss which is at the heart of this AI kind of logic. Now, so I want to talk a bit about meaning and counterfeits. All right. So, has anybody here ever made a counterfeit dollar bill? No? Good. I'm glad. That's the correct answer. Thank you. Okay. So obviously it's not easy to do, right? They deliberately make the money quite hard to copy, right? So if I was to try to make a counterfeit and then sort of take it down to my local shop and spend it, they would just look at me and say, "What are you doing? Get out of here." Right? Okay, fine. So that's a bad counterfeit, right? But it doesn't really matter, right? It's against the law, sure, but it's not really going to hurt anyone because nobody's going to take it. So, okay, I'm going to get better. I'm going to learn from the best, and I'm going to make a good counterfeit. So I make a good counterfeit that it can fool the tellers down at my local shop. And I'm going to go down and say, here's my $100 bill, and buy my stuff, right? Now that is better, right? But it's worse because now it's going to be fooled for something, okay? But then let's imagine that I was going to really want to perfect my craft. And I made a $100 bill that was on a molecular level indistinguishable from an actual $100 bill, right? You could look at it through an electron microscope and you could not tell the difference. It's physically identical. And I can manufacture them at scale. I can make a billion of these things, right? Does that make it a $100 bill? Is there a certain point at which I make a good imitation and then suddenly it's the real thing? Or am I just a good counterfeiter? So there comes a $100 bill is not currency because of its material properties. It's currency because we agree that it's currency. And the worth of it is an immaterial, like a dimension or immaterial property of the actual money itself. It's worth that because we trust each other, because I can go to a shop and we trust that we're going to be giving real money. That's why money matters. And so if I have a billion $100 notes, I can destroy an economy. It doesn't just enable me to do crime, it actually undermines the existence of an economy altogether. And this is the situation that we have with AI, right? People concentrate on the specific instances, which of course are serious. Kids are cheating in their school, and that's bad, yeah? And that's definitely something that needs to be addressed. The other day I was at a Adana, and there were some high school kids there, and I was talking to them about this stuff. And one of them she was in year 11, and she'd recently gone from advanced English to standard English. And she said that her experience was that in advanced English, that everyone was wanted to do the work. Everyone cared, and people didn't use AI. And then when she went to standard English, nobody cared, and everyone used AI. That, I think, really encapsulates something important about this, that there is one of the effects that this will have is the effect of stratifying society. Those who will do the actual work and those who are going to just cheat are just going to get by. And we're going to find that those differences will, I mean, just on an educational level, that's going to create more and more split between the good students and then the average students and so on. And it's going to, of course, obviously is going to massively undermine the education of the kids using AI. And look, I know I'm hardly normal in any particular way, right? But if I was an employer, I would absolutely be asking young applicants, did you use AI in your school? And I would be refusing to let anyone who used AI work for me because you can't trust that they know anything about anything and they've just been cheating their way through. And this is, even though that's a hypothetical scenario, but that's also a scenario I find in my life. I mean, currently, say, for example, one thing I'm going through now is I'm supposed to be contributing some chapters for a book, one of them on AI, but then I learned that some of the people writing for that book, writing other chapters, might be using AI. And so I'm like, yeah, no, I don't want to be in this book if my writing is going to be next to AI writing and you're going to be saying, so I'm currently having a discussion with the editors about that. We'll see what happens about that. So this is something that affects all of us, and it impacts all of us. So what we are seeing already is a degradation of the idea of meaning. So meaning is something that emerges in the interrelation and the connection between minds. Remember, I talked before about like the mind as a system or an individual as a system. And our system does not exist independently of other systems. Our system, our body and mind, exists in an interrelated nexus together with all of these others and with all of you people here today on this Zoom screen. And when I say something, okay, I say something, comes up from my mind, bubbles up somehow through perception and language, intention, right? It's complicated. We don't know exactly how that works, but it comes out my mouth and it comes out as sounds. Those sounds then go into that machine in front of me, encoded in binary code, blah, 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 through the internet, and then through various magical processes. Thank you to all of the very smart computer engineers who put all that together. Then they come out of your computer and into your ears. And then they are interpreted as those sound waves, vibrations, are interpreted as words in your mind, and you have a sense of meaning. And so you're like, what Bhante's saying doesn't mean anything. Or it does mean something, or whatever, but you interpret it as having a particular meaning. And that makes sense. So there's a connection between my mind and yours. Think about what I said before about Turing's problem. Like Turing said that we can't. Turing said that we have to know, like, is a machine good enough? Is a machine going to fool you or to imitate a human being well enough, right? And one of the reasons he's thinking that is because it's based on this idea that consciousness is actually inaccessible, that we can't actually know what the content of another person's mind is. But this, I don't think, is true. I don't think it's even trivially true. I think we know what the contents of other people's minds are all the time. And we can't necessarily know everything about them, but I don't know. I mean, I walk along the river and I see a tree. I don't know everything about that tree, but I know something about it. And we know something about other people's minds. And we know that through speech, through their actions, through their history, through their character, and so on and so forth. So I think we actually know about each other's minds all the time. I don't think it's as mysterious as we kind of make it out to be. Anyway, so if we think about meaning as being emerging from a contact between people's minds, then human speech has a meaning. And natural phenomena doesn't have a meaning in that same way. Right? So think about it. If I say the stars are beautiful tonight, then that's a statement that has a meaning, right? Because I'm saying it to you. But if I'm standing out here on my balcony and I'm looking up at the stars, are the stars actually beautiful or not? I might say they're beautiful. Somebody else might say, no, the stars look terrible tonight. They really need to get their act together. I don't know. I'm just making this up. Whatever. You get my point, okay? And which one's right, which one's wrong, right? A better example might be to say that, let's say we had some astrologers standing out there, and one might say, oh, yes, the moon of Capricorn is in the Aquarius tonight. That means we have to watch out for, I don't know, running into old lovers on the street. And then somebody says, no, it's actually the Scorpio moon is entering the Aquarius constellation. That means we have to be worried about meeting new lovers on the street, not old lovers on the street. And so they're both reading the stars as having a particular meaning. And there's no actual sense in which the stars actually have that meaning. That's purely a subjective invention because the stars aren't really talking to us. I'm sorry if there are any astrology believers there. By the way, astrology is fine, okay? There's like pretty pictures and people talk about their feelings and things like that. So it's fine. I don't have any particular problem with astrology, but I don't think that the stars are actually meaning anything to us. So when there's no consciousness, then there's no meaning and there's no creation of meaning. And so this is what's happening with AIs. When we read an AI, I would propose to you that, in fact, a sentence in an AI has no meaning. And an AI is not capable of producing anything with meaning. What it produces is strings of data that we hallucinate and imagine have meaning, just as somebody would look into the stars and imagine that those stars have meaning. And even if the same sentence is uttered, right, I might say the sentence, today is Sunday, and that sentence is true. It has a truth value, right? Or it might be false. Yeah? Or depending on the context, I might say today is Sunday, and that might be witty, right? Depending on the context, or it might even be profound or sad because it has a certain meaning. But if ChatGPT says to you, today is Sunday, it means nothing. It literally means nothing. And we are purely hallucinating meaning into it. So those of you who know how AIs work will know that the problem of hallucinations is always an issue. Basically, AI just makes stuff up. What I'm saying is that AIs don't hallucinate. We hallucinate. AIs are just producing statistically probable sequences of data. We hallucinate that it is a statement of meaning. Sometimes those statements of meaning correspond to other statements that sometimes those statements of illusory meaning correspond to other statements of actual meaning, like today is Sunday. And then we say, oh, it was true. Other times it doesn't. Sometimes you might, AIs constantly say ridiculous things. You say, what is it today? And then they'll say, it's Tuesday. And they make up stuff all the time. But what I'm suggesting to you is the problem is not that AIs sometimes get it wrong. The problem is that the more it becomes accurate, the more it becomes seeming to be right, the more it is fooling us. Just like the counterfeit dollar, which was not dangerous so long as it was poorly made. But when it is made to be accurate, that's when it fools you into thinking that it is actual money, but it still actually has no value. It's just a counterfeit. And it's exceedingly difficult to use these machines and to understand that this has no meaning. And people get drawn into these things constantly. And I'm just going to say from here, I don't trust anyone using these machines. I don't care how distinguished you are, how experienced you are, how intelligent you are. I was talking with a friend of mine, a colleague, very senior academic person, and this was actually a couple of years ago. It was actually in Germany as it happened, but this was when AIs were starting to be used, and I said, oh, they'll be using it for writing academic articles, journal articles, and so on. And then they said, oh, look, you can't do that. It's not allowed. I'm like, are you sure people never do things that are not allowed? But then I'm like, and then they were like, you know, but I have to admit, like, I do use it for, like, just for making outlines, you know? And but that's using AI. So you could see that in that person, very smart, very a lot of integrity, right? Absolutely sincere. They're actually already deluding themselves. Even at that basic level, they're actually deluding themselves about what they're doing. They're telling themselves, oh, no one would ever use their AI to write their article while they are using AI to write their article. Yeah? And that's how it works. It has this insidious nature that gets you and drags you in. Now, we have hopefully, you know, I'm talking from first principles, and I'm talking from philosophical and psychological background. I'm not talking about like the practical and more immediate ethical issues that AI have. But a lot of those things come from that fundamental nature that it has. And as AI gets rolled out, it becomes an instrument for the totalization of knowledge. So rather than genuine knowledge being produced by actual human beings, what we have is one pseudo-knowledge, which is in the hands of a few people. Now, I'm not going to sit here and rant for the next few hours on how all of those people are Nazis and pedophiles and psychopaths, but they very much are. And these are the most evil and dangerous men alive, and quite possibly the most dangerous men who have ever existed. Humanity has in the past invented technologies that were capable of destroying humanity. We invented nuclear weapons, knowing that this could destroy humanity. But everybody involved in inventing nuclear weapons was like, this is horrible. We must make sure it will never happen. Right? Now they're all saying, this is pretty cool. Yeah, we're going to end humanity and we're excited to see what's next. And Sam Altman said, and I'm paraphrasing, but almost word for word, what he says was, it's a good chance that we are going to end humanity. But in the meantime, we are going to create a lot of shareholder value. That is how these people think. That is who we have put in charge of trillions upon trillions upon trillions of dollars. And they are running these cities, these vast cities full of machines that are churning and churning and churning, burning up billions upon billions of dollars for creating devices to take the clothes off little children, for creating devices for kids to cheat at school, for creating devices to, like Jeff Bezos did, lay off a third of his staff at the Washington Post because he can use an AI instead, and to run governments, and to all of these things. When we're thinking about the ethics of AI, there is the way that the AI industry talks about the ethics of AI. They talk about alignment. They want to make sure that the AI is aligned with human interests, right? And this is the ethical language which they want to use. What do they actually mean by that? What they mean by that was revealed in the emails that were sent between Elon Musk and Sam Altman when they set up OpenAI. So these were exposed when they fell out and had a court case and so on, because they're all narcissists and they can't actually get along with each other. But one of them, I can't remember which one was now, I think it was Elon, proposed to Sam, we're going to have to make sure that this is like ethical and is aligned with the interests of humanity. We'll set up a council. It'll be you and me. I think five people should be enough. So we'll set up a council with you and me and three other people, and then that'll sort that out. So this is how seriously they're taking it. And I know that they will posit these things in public, and they'll say that they're being ethical and so on and so forth. But we've seen behind the scenes. We've seen what they actually say to each other, and we know better than to listen to their lies. So if we look at AI through an ethical lens, let's say we look at AI through the five precepts, easy enough. Does AI break the five precepts? Yes, all the time. It's built on massive destruction of nature, the death of countless animals to just create it. And not only that, but it's used to kill. AI is absolutely being harnessed to create kill chains that will target and murder people in Gaza. And now the same technologies are being used by Palantir, Peter Thiel's company, in the United States. And the same technology will be used in everywhere. This is one of the main reasons that they're doing it. And again, this comes back to Joseph Weizenbaum's critique about the computer industry being based on military desires and military needs. So killing, stealing, right? If you're using, okay, I just want you to be aware of this. If you're using ChatGPT, you're stealing my stuff, okay? I don't want you to be using it because I don't want my stuff in ChatGPT. I don't want it in Claude. I don't want it in any AI. And I don't have a choice. And nor does any writer, any poet, any screenwriter, any artist, anybody who does creative work or any kind of constructive work, any journalist, any academic, any scholar, all of their work has been taken up by these AI companies without any regard for copyright or any regard for anyone's wishes, and just being used. And this is theft. This is this is being used to deprive, to then take their work and then put them out of a job. Yeah. And I've faced this problem in my field. Like people are wanting to replace human translators of suttas with AIs. Yeah, company, but there are Buddhist organizations that are already doing this. And there was a moment about a year or so ago when I went to a conference, blah blah blah. I was in Taiwan, and there were a few AI developers at this table. We're having breakfast, and there was a very kind lady, local lady from in Taipei, who came up and gave us something for breakfast. And I knew her, she's one of my supporters. And we all thought, oh, thank you, that's very nice. And we're having some of these like little Chinese sticky rice cakes or something. And why did she do that? Why did she come up and offer these cakes for us? Well, why did she have that free time? She had that free time because she had lost her job to AI. So we're sitting around wondering about all the great things that AI can do. And well, here's a person who already has lost a job. This was a couple of years ago now. So of course it's getting much, you know, more and more worse. So theft, sexual misconduct. Are you kidding me? Okay. So one of the main focuses of AI is misogyny. It's to dehumanize and degrade women. And it's been launched at a massive scale. In the most degrading and horrifying crap that you can possibly imagine. And it hardly comes as a surprise to know that most of these AI guys are all in the Epstein files. Like, obviously, this is what is driving these things. Elon Musk's launched a chatbot on Twitter that is just takes clothes off women and takes clothes off girls. This is what they're doing. This is like a major driving force. And every so often on social media, there's one of the tech bros will say, I've had it with women. Women are too annoying. They always talk about their rights and their feelings. I'm just going to get myself a robot and just enjoy, have a sex bot for the rest of my life. And then all the women jump onto the thread and say, yes, please do that. Please get yourself a sex bot and leave us alone for the rest of your life. So this is a huge problem. I don't think we can overstate how significant that the sexual exploitation and degradation of women is due to AI. And then, of course, false speech. Right? And of course, we covered that, I think, mostly with the disinformation and so on. The lack of meaning. But just to note that AI produced content is now everywhere. It's in our legal system. It's in our legislation. It's in our policies. It's in our science. It's in our academic journals. And there's all of these cases of supposedly senior and respected people who are creating papers and doing work that is obviously AI. It's not that this is a problem just for, you know, a few students who are cheating with it. It's absolutely systematic. And I've seen, you know, again, even in my field, I see it. I see people using AI for their work. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not interested in your work if you're using AI. I immediately just stop reading it. Why would I read something? If you can't be bothered actually doing the work yourself, why should I be bothered to look at it? So, and then finally, I'm just going to mention the fifth precept on intoxication. Obviously, AI isn't an intoxicant, but it is addictive. And the addictive properties of AI have already led a number of people to psychosis, to suicide, and to madness. And the extent to which this is happening, I think, is massively underreported. I don't think it's just a few people. I think that there are huge amounts of people who are cooking their brains on this crap. And I think that it's not just in isolation. It's also in association with things like drug use, especially ketamine use, a dissociative drug. And this is creating, in my view, we are going to be looking back in 10 years' time and seeing a massive mental health epidemic created by AI. difficult to distinguish from the health, mental health epidemics created by all of the other terrible things that are happening. But I have no doubt that that's the case. So these are some of the things that like the lenses that we can look at AI from a Buddhist point of view. Now, I just want to briefly discuss, because I know each one of you, you may have some questions. Please, if you have any questions, you can put them in the chat or we can talk in a minute. But there's also the practical consideration, like what do we do? Now, I'm in a very privileged situation. I'm an old monk and I made all these books. See, these nice books. See, I made them myself with my own mind. And so that's good. So I've got kind of a legacy, to be honest. I feel like that's a good legacy. I feel like if I was to die tomorrow, I'd be like, yeah, I'm pretty happy. I did some good things. So if I do anything now, that's all right. I'll do it because I feel like it or because I like it. But I don't really feel like I've got anything to prove. But a lot of people are not in that situation. A lot of people are in a workplace, and it's expected. We hear countless stories of workers who AI is being pushed on them. And this seems to be a very widespread split where management is pushing AI and the people doing the work don't really want it. And when it's put into work, people find that, you know, there may be AI tools that are useful for certain things, but overall, they find themselves less productive. And there's been a number of studies done on this showing that people perceive that they're more productive using AI, but in fact are less productive. And that's been persistently organized, even for like coding and things like that, which you would imagine would be a good use case for AI. So I'm sure that probably each one of you are put in this situation or put in a situation where in schools, people are going to be asked to use AI and so on. I would beg you to please resist these as much as you can. I know we can't always shape these things, but just try to have an informed point of view and try to push back on these kinds of ideas. Informing yourself is good, and looking for alternatives is good. As a general rule, and Deepika and I have discussed this a few times, but as a general rule, it does seem to be the case that in developed societies where there's been a lot of technology in the classroom now for quite a few years, 10 or 20 years, that people are finding that it actually leads to adverse learning outcomes. And that there's a lot of movement towards reducing the amount of technology in the classroom. Now, obviously, that doesn't mean that there shouldn't be any technology, but we've seen like banning of phones in schools in New South Wales. And again, talking to the students generally seem to think it's a good idea. We've seen the under 16 social media ban as well. And again, people will have different views. Now, I'm in terms of policies, that's complicated, right? And I don't think that there's one answer, and I don't think that anybody knows really what the best policy is. I think we're in a situation now where we are starting to think what kind of policy would be good and starting to propose what might be possible to help out with this situation. Now, what I would say, though, is that medium-sized nations like Australia or Sri Lanka, perhaps even Germany, Singapore. These nations, I think, have a critical role to play in this regard. And if we push back on these things, then we can start to make changes. If Australia makes a law, Elon Musk will probably yell at us on Twitter and a few things. But if Singapore makes a law, and if Taiwan does, and if Sri Lanka does, then they're starting to have to take these things seriously. So obviously the EU has taken some leadership in this regard and has brought together some laws and so on. Now, I'm not expert in those laws, and so I can't really judge as to like what is the right regulatory framework. I'm not an expert in that field. But I do think it's important to establish that there should be a regulatory framework. And somebody once observed, an AI guy once observed recently, there are more regulations on a sandwich than there are on AI, which seems wrong somehow. Now, personally, if it were up to me, what kind of regulation would I propose? I would say that we should be banning AI as a rule and then allowing it on a whitelist. So we should be saying that this should only be approved in certain circumstances. So if you can say that there are genuine scientific reasons for it and so on, then okay. But I think we should be my personally, I think we should be preemptively banning AI and also other related technologies like mind brain, like brain computer interfaces. This one I've been thinking about recently, I think is also a dangerous one that will be coming down in the next few years. So, in your particular case, you probably have, maybe you have kids who are using AI. Sometimes the kids like it, sometimes they don't. Sometimes there are teachers who like it, sometimes there are teachers who don't. Sometimes you're at work, sometimes you can make a choice, sometimes you can't. But whatever happens, let me just say one thing. In my view, human ingenuity and intelligence and compassion and wisdom will never be replaced and it will never be bettered. And whether you're talking about just being a human being or if you're talking about getting a job, then the qualities that you develop will always be relevant and meaningful. And if people are saying to you, you have to use AI or you'll be left behind, to me, that's a really incoherent answer. If you have ingenuity and problem-solving ability, critical thinking, then honestly, using AI is not that difficult and you can figure out how to use it. It's also, I think, so I think that the argument that you have to use AI or be left behind is a self-defeating argument. And I'll just explain briefly why that's the case, because we either have two cases. One case is that AI doesn't get much better. That's what I think is going to happen. AI is probably plateaued and is not going to get that much better. If that happens, the AI industry is going to crater because it's completely financially unsustainable. And the skills that you've learned are not really going to mean anything. Or, on the other hand, AI does become much better, and the next generation of AIs is vastly superior to what we're using now, in which case, the skills you learn now are going to be meaningless anyway, because we'll just be using AI by putting a headset on and thinking what we want, and AI will be doing it or whatever. So I don't honestly think that there's a reasonable scenario within which actually learning AI skills is a meaningful thing for like job skills or career skills in the long term. But I do know that developing critical thinking, developing independence, developing like a compassion, ability to work with people around you, ability to listen, all of these skills are absolutely essential and will remain so forever. So I would urge people not to forego those things in search of a machine solution. All right. So thanks everybody for paying attention. There's a couple of things in the chat. But please, if people want to speak, please unmute yourself and ask a question. But meanwhile, I'll get to the chat comments. So Shanuka says, and Deepika has mentioned this to me before. Shanuka says, Sri Lanka is going to digitize the entire education system, primary, secondary, and tertiary. What are the safety precautions we are pushing back and opposing, but the government is so adamant? Yeah, look, I can't have any, I don't have any solution for you, I'm afraid. I'm just, congratulations, keep doing what you're doing. If you want any support from my end, I'm happy to do it. I'm writing a chapter. I mentioned before that I was writing a chapter for a book about this, and so I'm not exactly sure if it's going to be published, but in any case, I'm happy to share that with you on this topic. And I just want you to know that there are people all around the world who are sharing these things. I have a lot of friends in academia, in Australia, in the US, all around the world who are very worried about it and really kind of disturbed by a lot of the things that's happening. And they're disturbed by the way this is getting pushed by the administration and being used as an excuse for getting rid of people. So When you say that the digitizing of the education system, I mean, that's obviously very broad, much broader than just AI itself. And again, I mean, to a certain degree, obviously learning computer skills and digital skills is an essential job skill for the workplace. So that's certainly true. So there's certainly a place for digital education within the schoolroom. But the main thing that I would say would be to make sure that it doesn't come at the expense of the human education. There's 8 billion people. There's 8 billion intelligences on planet Earth. It's incredible. And most of those are undeveloped because of the lack of opportunity, because they haven't had the education, because they haven't got the nutrition and the support and all of those things. And we know that people can flourish when they are supported. We know that. That's not a speculation. That's not science fiction. We know that. And so we can do so much to actually help and to uplift people and to build on those strengths of actual intelligence rather than a fantasy of this scientific intelligence, of artificial intelligence. And it, you know, when people are pushing these things, I would urge you to remind them that all of these AI companies, OpenAI and Anthropic and all of them, are hand in glove with the Trump administration. And ask people, do you want our country to be more like America? Is that what you want? Do you want us to come under the control of those people? Just remember that when Elon Musk decided that it was a good idea to make Twitter able to take the clothes off young girls, he just made that decision. Oh, I'm just going to do this. When you put AIs into every classroom, they are subject to the whims of the people controlling those AIs. And they can and will change those things at any moment. And they can change it to change what information is given, how it is given, what facts are allowed and what facts are not allowed. And it is not paranoid to say that this will be weaponized and used against people, because we have seen evidence for more than a decade now that all of these companies, Facebook, all of them are utterly untrustworthy. They're utterly untrustworthy. And to put children's education into the hands of Google, no. Please don't do that. You know, I think maybe like if we were talking 15 years ago, then probably it'd be more reasonable. You'd be like, oh yeah, Google seems like a good company, it's whatever. But now we have so much evidence for the things that they've done. So yeah, I just give you my support and say I hope that you succeed in having reasonable policies. Anyway, Anne's comment. Here Anne says, I just asked my 13-year-old right before this. So your 13-year-old, so he's Gen Alpha. So he's going to be the first generation that's grown up with AI, right? We went to Adana yesterday and there was some kids about that, one girl was about that age as well. So that's a kind of distinguishing feature, right? So his education will be the first education AI. 13-year-old, if people in his school use it, he said, no way. They make fun of anyone who uses it, calling them bot lickers. Thank you, 13-year-olds. Awesome. I've heard also that AI is used as slang by kids as well. And so if the parents make up a story to their kids, they'll say, oh, come on, that's so AI. And so, yeah. It's interesting. It is interesting how the public perceptions of AI have really shifted. Like, I'm not sure, like, everyone lives in an information bubble these days. So I don't really know what most people are seeing or whatever. But what I'm seeing is a massive shift of sentiment away from AI and towards skepticism of it in the past few years. And yeah. Okay, so thanks. The next one, Prem, I thought it should not be too hard to enforce copyright laws against AI reproducing information that can easily be proved by comparing digitally. Yeah, this is a legal conflict which has been going on for some time. And again, it's one of those things where, like, originally AI was mostly used for research and science and things like that, and nobody was that concerned about it. But then when it became very widely available, then this became a very serious issue. So the standing legal finding in the United States is that copyright doesn't apply to AI because it's transformed. And there have been wide-ranging legal challenges to that by, you know, Hollywood, by New York Times, by all kinds of people, Disney. And it would be possible for an independent jurisdiction to stand up against that. And so if Australia, for example, or the EU or Sri Lanka was to stand up against that use of copywritten material, then that would start to be a challenge to the AI oligarchy. And again, this is not just speculation. These are the kinds of things which they say. They say that regulation is their greatest threat. This is why they took over the Trump administration. That's why Elon Musk spent hundreds of millions of dollars to get Trump elected, was precisely to evade this kind of thing. So yes, this is certainly one element that can and I believe should be used. Having said which, I'm not. I personally think that there should be a better way than in copyright laws were not designed for that purpose. And it's pressing copyright into an area that it wasn't, that to my mind doesn't exactly fit. So it could be one legal angle, but I think that there could be better. Personally, I think it would be better if there was a new kind of legal category that was established for AI materials. Anyway, AI is seen more as a marketing gimmick to sustain a new wave of trends, just like hardware and software and internet and mobile eras. We must continue with what is good for our own cultures. May the blessing of the Triple Gem be for you. Thank you also, Yadamini, I think. That also is a great point. I mean, AI itself is really a marketing term, doesn't have any particular definition. And yes, we've seen this be shoved into products constantly. It's difficult to think of a product that AI has been shoved into that's actually been made better because of it. I'm sure that some people like AI things. I remember when we bought my most recent phone, it had like the latest Android on it, and it had like Google's ads for, you know, all the amazing things that Google's AI can do. And their amazing things were you can get a photo and with a dress in it, and you can circle the dress and it will search for the marketplace where that dress is being sold and do pattern recognition so that you can then buy that dress. So great, I guess. I mean, the things that they imagine that people want, right, or that are going to be actually useful are so silly very often. A lot of AI is really about people looking for a solution. You know, it's not like, oh, they have a problem and AI is a good solution for it. It's that they need to use AI, and what can we find to use AI for? So Madhu asked about, I mentioned that using AI tools to sort of speed up work in coding, et cetera, is actually less productive than not using AI. I'm wondering if this is something that's anecdotal or whether there's valid evidence that shows that. Yes, so there's been a number of studies done in that regard. The anecdotal evidence is that people will usually say that it speeds up their work. But then if you actually study their work, it slows it down. So this is what the research generally has shown. Now, of course, we know how research goes. You can do different studies with different parameters and so on and get different results. But there's been a number of studies that have shown that. And there's been at least one meta study, which has also reviewed all of those other studies and that confirmed those findings. I can't remember the details of that now, but I can share that with you if I can find it. So definitely. And so, again, I'm not saying that especially because Madhu, as you're a scientist, like in science, there are opportunities for machine learning in particular examples. Now, I think especially if you have a curated data set, right, number one, right? So if you're doing, let's say, climatology, and I'm sure that there are applications in, you know, particle physics and so on, but you have a curated data set, which is going to be free from the copyright issues and so on. And then you can develop your own models that can then be used for statistical inferences. Then that kind of thing, I think, obviously has a use within, you know, within certain applications. I think, but I think one of the problems is that the hyperinflated expectations that have been sold to us about AI and the ridiculous sums of money that they're spending on it make it make it difficult to talk about the field at all, because you get implicated in this whole kind of thing. You know, they'll find one study that actually does something useful, and then that's used to justify the whole field and the whole vast range of things that go from seemingly innocuous all the way to horribly depraved, get sort of taken along. So that's why I think, like, especially for people who are experts and who are professionals in their fields, should be very cautious about using AI and not and we should be, if we are to use it at all, and I would you know, I would say try to avoid using it as much as possible. But if there are specific fields in which it is to be used, then to use it in a way that's considered and circumspect. One of the useful criteria was proposed by Timnit Gebru is a Ethiopian computer scientist and ethicist. She was the one who was sacked from Google for talking about the ethical problems with what Google. She was their ethicist, and she talked about the ethical problems and got the sack. So that solved that ethical problem. But she's terrific, actually. And one of the points that she made was that when you're testing a system, you can test safety according to the desired outcomes of that system. All right, that's a kind of a general rule. So let's say if you are designing a car and you want to test the safety in the car, then you can put crash dummies in there, and then you drive it against a barrier or something like that, and you can say, well, this is how cars are used, these are the circumstances in which cars have accidents, we've seen that this is how bad things happen, and we can test this range of things which we can then evaluate and say, how effective is this at actually reducing the injuries? Because we have a circumscribed and defined context for which we can understand the concept of safety. But with AI, that doesn't apply, because there is no circumscribed usage for it. It's just out there in the world, and people use it for whatever they want. So again, I think within limited professional contexts, for scientists developing a model or something like that, then yes, they have a specific model that they're doing. They're doing it for this purpose, and it's only useful for that purpose. So I think, again, that's much more justifiable. But anyway, obviously there are many complexities and many layers to this. But certainly, just to reiterate my main points here tonight, because I've been going on for quite a while, AI is not intelligent, it's not conscious, and it never will be. It's developing an imitation of consciousness. And from a Buddhist point of view, what matters is one who feels, vairi manasa, vairi manasa. That's what the Four Noble Truths is taught for. AI, it does not feel, and it never will do. And so what it does is it creates this anthropomorphizing effect where we read our own consciousness into it. So this is creating and amplifying delusion. And a lot of the ills of AI are secondary effects from that amplification of delusion. So personally, if it were up to me, I'd have a Butlerian jihad and I would destroy AI. Again, if you're science fiction fans, you'll know the term Butlerian jihad. It's from the Dune universe. AIs took over and so on. They decided to destroy them. And the edict that Frank Herbert used there was, I think, quite nicely put. He said, and I'm just thinking the exact quote is, "Thou shalt not make a machine in the appearance," I think is the word he used. "Thou shalt not make a machine in the appearance of a human mind." Something like that. Yeah. Okay, we're at about 90 minutes now, I think, are we? Yes, we are.
Yeah, about.
So a couple of people are leaving already.
Thank you very much, Bunting, for
No
accepting my
problems.
request.
Thank you, Deepika, for organizing this.
Great. Yeah, there was a need, so I thought I couldn't think of a better person to ask. Yeah, so it gives some
And
motivation.
yeah, thanks everybody for coming along.
Thank you
And
very.
if you want to know, I might just put this in there just briefly. If you want to know more in detail about a lot of the things that I've been writing, I have a small mini site called meaningless.ai. No. Oh, no, hang on, hang on. No, that's the thing. One second. Where I've collected my essays on AI. So a couple of years ago, I did a deep dive into researching about this and a lot of the ethics and so on about AI. And so the essays are collected there, and I add to them every now and then. Oh, and by the way, I'm just going to show you something. If you go to that website, okay, you'll see a picture that I drew. I'm going to screen share right now. Can I screen share?
You should be able
Yes,
to.
I'm going to screen share. And right, that. Okay, so can you see the picture?
Yes, we do.
Okay, very good. So I drew that picture as an example of the worst image ever drawn, still better than AI though. And so that was how I began my thing. And our student here in Sydney, Sumana, did a nice version of that. So that's now me as an astronaut landing on the moon, planting the Dhamma flag on the moon. So that's human creativity, right? Nothing like it. Yeah. Okay. I think that should be it. Thanks, everybody.
Yeah, thank you, everyone. Thank you.
Thanks, Deepika and Madhu. And
Thanks,
Roshini
Bhante.
and Prem and all of the others who've been with us,
Yeah.
and hopefully you will enjoy your life as a human being. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Sadhu,
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 sadhu. Thank you
sadhu.
so much. Thank you,
Okay.
Bhante.